Hey folks, do you remember the good old days when every single call we went to seemed to be the most important thing we were doing at the moment? Well, we're going to talk a little bit about how maybe now we're picking and choosing and prioritizing and what that might mean for the quality of service that we're delivering. Also, we're going to talk about the idea of, do fire chiefs have a shelf life and why might that be? All that and a little bit more coming up on the next episode of Tailboard Talk right after this.
I'm Chris Young. No matter who you are or what you do, accidents can happen.
But some are preventable if you put a spotlight on fire safety.
Install smoke alarms on every floor and inside and outside of bedrooms. Replace any over 10 years old. Have fire extinguishers within reach and carbon monoxide alarms on each floor. And practice your escape plan.
In a fire, every minute counts. These simple steps can save your life and the lives of firefighters. Join me and put a spotlight on safety.
Welcome to Tailboard Talk with Dane Carley, Craig Nelson, and Jeff Wallen. Every month we explore different topics of interest to you, our cohorts in fire and emergency services. So whether you sit back and listen, sound off on the message board, or call in live to be part of the conversation, we welcome you to join us in our mission to improve the fire service for those we serve and those we serve beside. Now coming to you live from the Great White North, this is Tailboard Talk on Fire Engineering Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome to Tailboard Talk for Friday, November 18th, 2017. I'm Jeff.
It's Dane.
And Craig is not joining us today because he is out at the National Fire Academy doing some training while we were doing the pre-taping of this show for this Friday occurrence.
Fourth year of the ZFO program, last one.
Whew, that's got to be a nice feeling, wouldn't you think?
I would think so. I know how I felt.
I know it was when I was there. Yeah. Anyways, so hey, congratulations on year four. You still got that paper, Craig. You can't slack off. You get that paper in.
That's right.
Yeah, so good luck. Good luck with that. So even right now, we don't know for sure that he hasn't gotten kicked off the campus for poor behavior.
That's true.
We don't know that for sure.
That's true.
All right. Well,
you never know with him.
Well, gosh, hopefully that's not the case. Hopefully you made it back good and safe, and you get that paper in, and everything is good. You might notice in the background we are taping live at one of the numerous fire stations across this U.S. instead of the normal studios that we're at. You might hear a little bit of background every now and then while we're doing that too. Hey, we got a good show coming up for today. We're going to talk a little bit about fire chiefs.
Well, we are going to talk a little bit about fire chiefs, and we're going to talk a little bit about whether the fire service is trading off effectiveness for efficiency, whether we're giving up one for the other.
And we're talking a little bit of politics,
Politics, strategic politics,
All right, we got. Are you going to drop the name Trump in there at any point in time?
Oh, I hope not.
Or Clinton?
No, I hope not. I don't want to get into politics.
I think you might have to stay tuned in.
It might happen. You never know.
All right. It might happen. Oh, we should actually just jump right into it then, I think.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
I've always thought that a chief has a 5 to 7 year window. The typical chief has a 5 to 7 year window. Yeah. And there are exceptions. Some don't make it to 5 and some can go 15 and do a good job. But I never could understand why. And the idea that gelled in my mind is that for the first 2 or 3 years, the chief makes decisions that are in the interest of the department. The department is that chief's focus. In the 3 to 4 or 5 years, the chief makes strategic political decisions in the interest of the department. So they're starting to dip their toes into the political arena, and they work the politics to the advantage of the department. At that 5, 6, 7 year mark, now it's political. They don't make the decisions in the best interest of the department. They make decisions in the best interest of their survival to get their contract for the next year because they're playing politics with the city manager and city council. And as the chief progresses through that transition, that's what we see at the end, why it seems like chiefs only have a 5 to 7 year shelf life is because in that 5 to 7 years, they've quit worrying about the department, and they've started focusing on the politics. But that might get us in trouble. And I don't know if there's any validity to it.
I don't know either. But that's a terribly interesting subject to delve into, in my mind.
Let's do it.
Because
I don't care.
Yeah. And then how about the reverse engineering of that? So as a city organization, When you promote or hire a brand new fire chief, what are your expectations? or what do you feel you can support and what you can't support and achieve. So is that also, is it part of a systemic issue that you have? So when the city manager first starts, and every city is different, every organization is different to a certain point. Part of it depends on why they were hired. Were they hired to substantially change the organization? Were they hired to maintain the status quo? And you've got to think that the outliers would be those who are hired to implement dramatic change, either to build or change or tear down the organization. So most of them are probably concerned with the general maintenance of their city services and modernizing services or making sure you're keeping up with change of pace of technology and all that kind of good stuff. So you expect the new leader to make some kinds of changes to hopefully make sure that the department is where it ought to be and is going in the direction it should be going. So do you feel like you need to provide that support in the first few years to give the chief enough support, enough ammunition, enough resources to determine, yes, are they going to be an effective leader? Are they going to support effective operations of the department for the city and in the interest of customer service? And do you have an obligation to provide support for an initial fire chief for a certain period of time, almost regardless of how they're performing, because it's the building year. This is a building season for us. We're getting our team together. We're not going to get a Super Bowl ring this first year. We're expecting to try to get some key things in place that you'll notice increasingly better performance over the next couple of years, and then after that, we'll see.
Right. And I think that window gives them the opportunity to build some credibility with their staff, because oftentimes those changes are ones that the staff have been looking for. You know, a lot of times that's what a chief comes in and in those first couple of years, makes changes that the staff has been asking for, and the city council or city administration, let's just call them, gives them that leeway to make those changes, because they do want some change. They don't want necessarily the status quo.
Right.
So that gives them the credibility for those future years.
Right.
For a little while.
And what happens from a city manager and a council's perspective if the changes that are made in the first two or three years to address issues, which probably involve an infusion of resources, financial resources for the organization, what if that chief expects that to be the norm, that, hey, I expect to see new investment every single year and a substantial investment in either resources or people or what have you? So that it's not just we're going to take 3 years and we're going to focus more on the fire department and get that kind of back built back up to where it needs to be and move on. But what if the expectation is, well, we've got a long ways to go. We've got a lot of other things we want to do, too, besides just this other stuff right here. Does the support language after a little while saying, this isn't going to be the norm for every year, you understand.
I agree.
And nobody says that up front, necessarily, but
I think that's
also
reality.
One of the pressures that get that, listen, we are not... Don't expect to see 10% growth in your organization year after year. We might support that for a year or two to get some initiatives, but
right. We
can't support that for the next 10 years.
But I think that's when you look at that model that I was describing, where the first two or three years is all about the department, 3 to 5 or so years is strategic politics, and then after that is just politics. You can play strategic politics. Yeah, you're not going to get, if you got a 10% increase year one and two, everybody knows that's not going to happen year after year after year after year. That's impossible to sustain. There we go.
Mm-hmm.
But you can play strategic politics, still have the best interests of the department in place, but give, because the city administration ultimately says what the fire department has. We all know that. But the fire chief has a responsibility, because he's the fire chief, to do what's best for that department, not what's best for the city. He might do... or she might do what's best for the city in the interest of that coming back to the fire department's benefit in the future, which is strategic politics.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, it seems like an awful lot of chiefs in that 5, 6, 7 year mark all of a sudden quit worrying about the fire department, because they're looking at the politics of it. They're looking at their raise. They're looking at their contract. They're looking at whatever. And I wonder if a piece of what comes into there is, after, I know how fast my skills, I don't run medical calls anymore. I know how fast my medical skills have deteriorated from when I was on an engine to being a BC. At some point, that 5 year mark seems to be the point where when you've sat behind a desk for 5 years, you lose touch with operations. And not only that, but now you've decided, you know what? I know better what the department needs because the city administration has told me what the department needs better than what my operations people need. So I'm going to go with what the city administration said, even though operations is saying we need this or we need that or we could do a better job here if we had that. You know, it's not need isn't really the right word to use, but the operations is suggesting, no, we should really do this or we should really look at doing that. And the chief at that point, to that 5 to 7 years, says, oh, no, I have so many years of experience that there's no way that sitting behind a desk for 5 years is taking that away from me. So I'm not going to listen to you because I know what's best for the department. It seems like there's a mindset change, and I can't put my finger on it. It's mm-hmm. a combination of a couple of things. I think it's the desk job, the disconnect from operations, and the politics all kind of come into play together. You know, I don't know that it's those three things entirely, but it seems like they play a part in the chiefs that survive and are respected. And respect doesn't mean that you give the fire department, you don't give the fire department members everything they ask for. I mean, the fire department members mm-hmm. have to understand that the chief is in a very tight spot because the chief answers to the city administration, which represents the community that the fire department serves. And I understand that. But the chiefs that maintain that respect for beyond that 7 years, up to 10, 15, 20 years, sometimes you see chiefs survive very well, are the ones that can find the balance between, and in my mind, and I don't, like I said, it's hard to put your finger on it because there's no, you know, I'm basing this on my personal experiences, but with watching, you know, you look at St. Paul and Minneapolis and locally, and you look across the country, there's chiefs all over the country that run into these same issues that you read about. At what point how do those chiefs who have 15 years on maintain that respect? And part of that to me is they find that balance between the politics and the department. Mm-hmm. They maintain that strategic politics that you see in a chief from 3 to 5 years, that strategic politics where you still keep the department's best interests in mind while playing the politics that you need to with the city administration to be successful. You don't transition into the pure politics side of it. And I feel like the chiefs that have the most trouble are those who transition into pure politics and the ones that don't listen to their operations. And if you look at a high reliability organization, of the five things that Wyke said was a high reliability organization, number three was listening to the people that work in the streets, listening to their suggestions, because as a battalion chief, the firefighters and captains are going on calls, and they're seeing the effects of our decisions on operations, and they're bringing that to me. Well, then I'm going to go up to the assistant chiefs or whoever the next level supervisor is. I'm going to say, hey, this is what's being seen in the streets. And if a chief decides to quit listening to the people that are on the streets, you've lost a huge component of that HRO, because the chief is making decisions, sitting at a desk, looking at a computer, reading numbers, and saying these numbers all fit. This has got to work. Well, no, it doesn't have to work. Anybody mm-hmm. can work numbers any way they want to. Trump can make sense out of numbers that other people can't, and you know Hillary made sense out of numbers that other people can't. You know, you look at both sides of the spectrum. Those are two extremes. They both can make sense with numbers. The same topic can have different numbers, and a chief can do the same thing and take the numbers in any direction they want to.
Part of that with the losing touch with the firefighters out on the street, can part of that also be, I don't want to say guilty by association, because we're not necessarily saying right or wrong or trying to condemn anybody or anything like that, but does part of it also revolve around the circles of people that you maintain contact with and spheres of influence? So for those chiefs that do get into that pure politics area, is it because that you're operating within that realm, or you've been operating with other department directors, city managers, city leaders, or other other outside agency department heads, even chiefs of other departments, to where you then get isolated from the needs of your organization because you're, all, I guess to use a Heifetz and Linsky kind of reference, you're staying at the 30,000-foot level.
Yep.
And you're never coming back down to interact with the other folks.
Yep.
And so then you're only dealing with theory, I guess, at that point.
No, that's exactly, and it's funny you pulled that example, because that's exactly where I was going to go with it. You know, they talk about in the Fire Academy program, they talk about staying on the balcony or getting down on the dance floor.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's a great point is that sphere of influence is the city managers, is the other fire chiefs, and they're up on the balcony all the time. and it looks like everything's going great from the theory side of it, like you're talking about, the big picture side of it. But when you get down on the dance floor and actually start to interact with the other people, the other players, the operations personnel, then you start seeing the people are tripping over each other's feet, to keep that analogy going. Mm-hmm. Because when you get down into the details, there's things that aren't fitting into the bigger picture. So I think that's a great example. Yeah, that's very true. I think that does play a part. So then, isn't the answer to that listening to your operations people when they make a suggestion?
I would have to think that it is.
Or coming down and working the... Well, like I said, I don't... Like I said, a whole other topic. I think once you've sat at a desk for a certain amount of time, it's hard to come back into operations. Because it's like an EMS skill. If I don't practice EMS, my EMS skills go away. We've talked about this in another show very recently.
Right. Yeah.
If you don't practice your incident command skills every day, then it's tough to get into that mindset again and operate, you know, making decisions right away. So maybe we don't want them. I don't know. I'm not going to go there.
That's a whole different subject that dabbles with taboos, possibly, that I'd love to comment as well on, and I could from some personal experience along those same lines. But it feels like there's also a little bit more here to it than just the simplicity of, hey, if you're not out working with the operations staff, at least to a certain degree, keeping your feet wet, that you might lose contact with it. And maybe I'm trying to overcomplicate it, but I don't know.
I think you're on the right track. I think somehow, you know, for the other side of the story, I think that operations people don't have enough exposure to the administrative side. We don't see the pressures that the administration has to deal with. We don't see the city managers. We don't see the city council. And so we don't necessarily understand, because I'm mostly operations. So I don't understand a lot of the pressures that come from the city, from the top down to the chief.
Mm-hmm.
But just the same, the chief doesn't understand how, or the chiefs, I'm not picking on one person, I'm using that as a general term.
Yeah.
The chiefs who are our administration don't understand how the decisions they're making affect the operations all the time, because they don't come down into operations. And I don't have the skill set to go on the administrative side. I would be the first one to tell the wrong person to go stick it, probably. And I know that, and that's why I've decided that I'm pretty comfortable where I am. But at the same time, the administration, who is good with dealing with people like that, doesn't always have an operational mindset. And so somehow you got to cross those paths. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're right. I mean, you're on the right track.
Yeah, there were two things that came to mind while you were talking as I'm trying to figure out what's gnawing at my brain. And one of them that came into mind was that you can end up having a perspective shift based, and this is based on your sphere of influence, based on those people that you're interacting with and at what level and in what context. So it's sort of a complicated thing. But again, if you're up at that higher level, if you're standing on the balcony looking over the operations, do you end up getting clouded in your judgment? We all can wear rose-colored glasses and all that. But at that level, do you get a little bit clouded by the opinions of other department directors and the city manager, folks that are thinking about these higher level issues that other people just can't understand? That word that you said, the pressure, you used the word pressure, don't understand the pressures of management. And I was smiling inside about that pressures thing, because that's getting really touchy-feely for you, actually. And I always don't understand the pressures today that our young people are subjected to, and all this kind of stuff. But part of that goes along with that, and part of it goes along with the perspectives in that if you're viewing longer-term impacts of things, you tend to maybe tune out at the time the real-time impacts of things that are happening, or the longer-term impacts of the current term operations or activities. I don't know. You know, it's that part of it is that idea that you said, you know, you get that certain supervisor that if you present a really good idea to that supervisor, it might fall on deaf ears and it's not worth our time and it can't be done and what have you. But if you end up floating a portion of the idea ahead of time without trying to sell it and come back to them and then talk to that supervisor as if it was partly their idea, all of a sudden it's the best idea in the world, right? Right. And part of that is that when a chief officer is losing touch with the little things and goes to implement something or goes to address an issue or not address it because it doesn't appear to be something that long-term is going to have any kind of impact, it plants little seeds down in the operational level that can grow and fester into things that then get in the way of the organization without even realizing that you're doing that. Because it seems so inconsequential at the time, but if you're never down there seeing what's going on, it's like that mold growth behind the wall or something. But it's that kind of thing where if you're not realizing it's there, by the time you see it, it can be so far beyond the point of being able to be controlled or impacted that there's little you can do about it. And I wrote down another word, and that was assumptions. And I think it goes along with perspectives. If you think about you've been a battalion chief for a while now, it can be very easy to assume that we come out with a new policy as a department, outlining how we're going to change a procedure. And you say, okay, great, I get it. I can see where this is going. I can see how this policy is probably going to change again in 3 to 5 years to where it's going. And I see what other organizations are doing. It's a no-brainer. Little tweak to what we're doing, not a big deal. Let's just push it out to the folks, and the captains can take care of training people in if they need to, but most people should be able to just read through it and pick up what's going on, and we're fine. You move on, go about your daily business, and then you come to find out that as this trickles down to the troops, first of all, great, they didn't even take the time to explain it to us. They just pushed this thing out. I don't understand why they're doing the change. Why do we even need this? This is ridiculous. It's going to be worse than it was before. They're not even taking into account the 5 different things about the way this is going to affect me. And it's not until 4 to 6 months later that you all of a sudden find out that it's torqued off a whole ton of people, not only about the change, but how the change occurred, and the fact that you were so insensitive to the needs of the people working that you implemented the change this way, and how it's going to impact customer service and all this kind of stuff. And the whole program, whatever's behind it, has now effectively been killed because of the way it's been delivered, even though it might be very minor in the first place. But just through your assumptions, your perceptions, the fact that you were not able to interface with people who got different perceptions, the whole thing goes off track. And
oh, for sure.
I think about how this comes out at times. Lord help the folks that have to go through real serious budget crises with their departments. I was thinking about, I don't know all the details, but back out of the Fire Academy, we got into a short discussion about some of the issues that Baltimore was facing. Probably 2 to 3 years ago, where they were doing some rolling brownouts and trying to deal with it was Baltimore City, not county, right? I think it was Baltimore City.
I think it was too. Because
they hired Chief Clack from Minneapolis, who was the chief there for a while, right?
Yep.
And I keep thinking about if you're discussing issues of how to deal with obvious shortfalls and you have to make hard choices. Do we close stations? Do we brown out and rotate crews in hopes of being able? Here's maybe one of the perspective things. A chief might very well say, let's brown out stations, let's spread the risk out amongst the rest of the city, and our hope is that we will be able to regain a more solid budget position. We will be able to hire additional staff to start closing those gaps, and as long as we keep the gaps open by stations that we can't fully staff 24/7 the way that we want to, there can be the opportunity for public outcry or to be able to justify that we need to make incremental steps to get those staff members back in to fully open the stations. Sounds reasonable to me. I'm a chief officer, not the chief, but a chief officer. I can see where that's a perspective. But I could also see where the perspective is, this is ridiculous. They're cutting staff and they're not doing anything about it. They're just trying to make it look like the stations are open. But, you know, 2 days out of the month or 6 days out of the month, there's nobody there, or overnight that station's closing altogether and nobody knows it, and this is ridiculous, and the chief won't pony up and stand up to the people. They're just going to do this kind of thing and just try to hide it and sweep it all under the rug. Two very reasonable arguments for the same situation that's going on. And you don't know whose vision is right, or there's third or fourth ways around this, or what's going on, but you can see how by the time movements to try to address this on either side of the argument can get geared up and spooled up and are pushed out to the public, to the council, to civic and city leaders and community leaders, by that point in time, it's too late to change directions, to move in the tracks at all. One or the other side will be dug in so hard that it doesn't matter what solutions you try to come up with. The evil has already been done. The bad decisions, the bad intent, the inconsideration of providing for the services or for the employees or the neighborhoods, that it's all lost at that point because you've been operating up at that higher level without interacting with people who are not,
right,
and vice versa.
And I agree. I think that's a great example. So let's look at that for a second. And, mm-hmm. and I have we have that example, and then I have another example that was the exact opposite. That went really well. And I think brownouts are good. When we see them in St. Paul, when the super medic stations get closed down and browned out, or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. you see it happen in Milwaukee's closing stations right now.
Super medic stations? Not everybody might know what a super medic station
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I don't even know what it is, but I think it's a combination where you actually see St. Yeah, Paul runs their
engine company and medic. And a medic out of the same station, ALS transport.
But
and at times the engine crew will jump on with the ambulance and go out together as a unit.
Well, I think most of their stations, and someone from St. Paul will probably email us and say, you got this computer wrong.
Probably.
But my understanding of it is they have an engine and a medic.
Broadcasting from the enhanced station today.
A super medic, or St. Paul has an engine and a medic in each station, and when they get a medical call, the engine crew moves to the medic unit and takes the call. My understanding is that a super medic station is where the engine and the medic are both actually completely staffed, so they don't have to cross staff the unit.
Oh, okay.
When they close what they call a super medic.
Central, engine one.
Engine one.
They're going to take it because they're closer.
Engine one is taking that call for SQR. We're going to go.
Parking
brake
test.
Super medic station is closed or browned out, my understanding is that they have just enough staffing to staff one or the other, not both at the same time.
Okay.
That's my understanding of it from what I know about it.
All right.
But anyway, so you look at St. Paul, you look at Milwaukee's closing station. I think last I heard they're going to close five stations, Baltimore. But to go back to what we were talking about, the perspective I think is the important piece here is, from a chief's point of view, browning out a station here and there is the perfect answer because, like you said, it spreads the risk around the community. It's not a permanent answer. We're not going to close that station permanently like Milwaukee is, actually. We're trying to make this better. You know, we're trying to look at the big picture. And the big picture in a city like Baltimore probably has 30, 40 stations. You brown out a few now and then. That's on the big picture, that's if you have, say, a million personnel hours every given day because you have so many stations and you only lose 200 of those personnel hours, that's just mm-hmm. that's a drop in the bucket.
Right.
It's minuscule, it's perspective-wise. But to that community, to that neighborhood that station's brown out in, that's a big deal. So perspective, I think, is a huge deal. That engine crew that serves that community, that serves that neighborhood, sees it as a huge deal because now that neighborhood is not being protected, and that's their neighborhood. That's what they do. That's their job. And the battalion chief is looking at it like, hey, now my battalion's short an engine. Now I got to wait for an extra 3-4 minutes to get another engine or another truck company into here to do a rescue or to do pull the hose line. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right. A perspective is a big deal, but which one is right? And I think that takes us to which one. Are we looking for efficiency or are we looking for effectiveness?
That's a good argument to make, and I think we ought to devote a full segment of the show to that. So let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk about efficiency and effectiveness. You're listening to Tailboard Talk? Yep, on Fire Engineering Talk Radio.
Are you sure it's Tailboard
yep.
Talk?
Pretty sure.
Hi, boys. Welcome to Jack's Fish Shack. What can I do for you?
Hey there. We was wondering about the ice on the lake. Is it okay to go on then?
Yeah, but you should stay away from Moonbeam Bay. There's a patch of
what you're hearing is a day in the life of Jack's Fish Shack. Fishermen always stop by to get up-to-date information about ice conditions on the lake.
So you're saying we shouldn't go near the Crappie Narrows Bridge?
Right. Now, can I make you some of Jack's famous live bait sandwiches? They only wiggle for a couple bites.
Oh. The best way to learn about ice conditions is to ask people who know the lake from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Hey, what's up? We're Ruby Summer for Rad. Music is one of the most important things in our life.
But nothing is more important than life itself.
Good morning, world. It's nice to wake up to another...
So when you know your friend should not get behind the wheel, drive them home or call them a cab and give them a Rad My Safe Ride home card.
I wanna live my life with mermaids.
Music lives and so should you.
Brought to you by Rad My Safe Ride Home and Shawnee Records.
Friends don't let friends drive drunk. Do you?
Did you know you don't need a license to broadcast on the internet?
Keep that in mind as you listen to Tailboard Talk on Fire Engineering Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Tailboard Talk on Fire Engineering Talk Radio with Dane and Craig and Jeff. Jeff's not here. No, hold it. Craig's not here. That's right. I am here. You are Dane.
Yep.
And have you been ordained?
I have not been ordained.
I have not been ordained either. I thought about going on the internet and seeing if I could become one of them their preacher, pastor type folks. And then I could create my own church and maybe get some donations in.
Yeah, you could be tax exempt.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, great ideas that we have here that go nowhere in the show.
Yeah.
Right. But anyways, before we took a break, we were talking about chiefs and politics and effective politics.
Effective versus efficiency, strategic politics.
That's what I was looking for,
strategic politics.
And then we were talking about browning out stations and how that related to efficiently delivering services before we got too far down a rabbit hole.
Yes.
Yeah, and we're pre-recording this show today, too, so don't bother calling in live. There's going to be nobody here to answer your calls and questions, but feel free to send Dane all the email that you want.
All right. Well, yeah. I think, you know, we left, actually... at an interesting point, we somehow ended up working our way into a discussion about efficiency versus effectiveness. And by chance, this is something that's been on my mind. Well, actually, Craig and I have written about it quite a bit. The three of us have talked about it in radio shows before. But it came back to my mind again when I was reading Mark Von Oppen's post at Fully Involved recently, and he shared Daddy's Girl, the blog article that he made, that he wrote quite a few years ago. He shared it again with a little different perspective. He introduced it with basically talking about statistics. Statistically speaking, and I'm reading this, I'm quoting Mark Von Oppen to give him credit on his Fully Involved page. Statistically speaking, you might not ever need us, but when the most important person to you in the world, statistically speaking, needs us, hopefully the metrics will line up correctly so we can get there in a timely manner with the right resources so that the person so dear to you doesn't become an acceptable loss, statistically speaking. Statistics aren't everything when lives are involved. And that really got me, it was an interesting way to look at this, and I think we can all relate to the blog article. I think all of us can read that and probably think of at least one call, if not many, that in the situation he was in. But it got me thinking more about the way he introduced it, because when I started in the fire service, I had a captain tell me, and this was 89 or 90, I mean, it was very early in my fire service, so I had a very moldable mind. Some people tell me that's not the case anymore, but I did then.
Yeah, but you got softer edges now.
All right. I got softer
edges. They're not as compressible as they used to be.
the captain said, you know what, as an engine company, as a fire department, as a fire service, we always prepare for the worst and hope for the best. That was how we looked at our job. That was how we looked at what we did. We always prepare for the worst and hope for the best. Whether we're training, we train like it's the worst thing that could happen, and we hope that we never have to use it. If we're responding to a fire alarm, we prepare for a working fire with people trapped, and we hope it's nothing but a false alarm. If we're going to a traffic accident, we prepare for auto extrication and hope that it's a fender bender. You know, no matter what you're doing every day, we used to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And it's interesting to me, this transition, and I've seen it happen in law enforcement as well, and I think that'll give us some examples we can use to make this transition that I feel like the fire service is going through now. We don't prepare for the worst and hope for the best anymore. We, as a fire service, use numbers, we use statistics to say that we're going to do this for you 90% of the time. Or we're going to do that for you 90% of the time. We can't guarantee anything the other 10% of the time, because that's our window of error, let's say. And granted, we can't be the fire department. No fire department can be 100% 100% of the time. No fire department can ever deal with every single problem that's going to be thrown at it 100% 100% of the time. I understand that. What bothers me is that by prioritizing medical calls, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta calls now, by prioritizing them and not running lights and sirens to all of our medical calls, by sending only one engine and one truck to a fire alarm, or not responding lights and sirens to a different call, or whatever the case may be, we're not going out the door We're not telling our firefighters to go out the door with the understanding that this is the worst day of somebody's life. They're calling 911 because it's the worst day of their life. And it has subtly changed our culture. Our firefighters nowadays are good people, but their mindset is not the same as it was when we started. They're not prepared for the worst and hoping for the best. I just think that the culture piece, by doing this and teaching our new firefighters that not everything is a priority, we've bred this culture. It's one of those things where action speaks louder than words. We can say, we can tell the firefighters all day long, every time you respond out of the station on a call, it's that person's most important day, or they wouldn't have picked up the phone and dialed 911. You can tell them that all day long. But through actions, by prioritizing calls, by making some of them less important than others, because that's what we've done by only sending an engine and a truck or whatever your department's decided to send to an active fire alarm, mm-hmm. We've prioritized calls and said this one's less important. We've taught them through our actions and through our department's policies that we don't have, it's not always prepare for the worst and hope for the best. We're trying to be efficient. And I think as a fire service, because of that, I feel like in the name of efficiency, in the name of we'll do this job with the resources that you've given us, we can tell you that we'll be able to do this job 90% of the time. We've lost effectiveness because we can't try to do that job 100% of the time. We're no longer trying to do it 100% of the time. We used to try to do it 100% of the time. We couldn't because every department has its limitations, but that was at least the mindset is we're going to go out there, we're going to give it 100%, 100% of the time. Now it's like, well, because it's cheaper or because we're saving money here or because we're more efficient or whatever the case may be, whatever statistic and number you want to pull up, whatever metric, whether it's engine availability or it's response times or it's personnel per dollar or whatever you want to look at, it doesn't matter. We're saying that we're not trying to be 100% 100% of the time anymore. We're trying to be 100% 90% of the time. And I think that that's taught our firefighter. I think it's changed the culture of the fire service. And I think the reason I brought law enforcement up as an example is law enforcement has for a long time prioritized their calls because a vandalism call is not as important as a bank robbery. I get that. And for us, someone who's been sick for 3 days and decided to go to the hospital on the third day maybe isn't as important as a working fire. I mean, I get that, but at the same time, by putting it into policy, we've taught them the wrong things, and our culture is changed, has shifted. It's a subtle, but to me, important shift in how we look at what we do.
I think to make it real, you have to see real world examples of other organizations or industries where you can see this and see what the impact is, because I think it's too easy to get too far down the road before you realize that you've been making mistakes or that you haven't been providing the level of service that the customer wants. And I know we've burned out the idea of customer service. At least a decade ago, we burned it out by using it too much, and even perhaps offending our staff at times by saying we need to provide the best customer service all the time. You mean we're not? And what's kind of funny is I think at the time, maybe 10 years ago, when we were, as an industry, a lot more focused on customer service and following a lot of Brunacini's examples of what high levels of customer service look like, I think a lot of our organizations had been doing that culturally for decades. Mm-hmm. And to see it named as a thing that we should be focusing on probably offended a lot of staff folks into saying, so you're telling me we're not doing this? This is what we're all about. But yet we're at the point now 10 years later where I don't think that we are teaching those principles anymore. And so as some examples, and maybe Phoenix was ahead of the curve in that because of the explosive growth that the Phoenix metro area had been seeing for 20 or 30 years in their planned growth model and stuff, maybe they were seeing things that the other fire service hasn't had to deal with yet or is dealing with now. I'll try to rush through these quick. So one of them is police department example that you talked about. And I can see if I put myself in the terms of, let's say, not me, but my wife. let's say, or my daughter or my son, if they were out at Target and somebody had run into the car, severely damaged the car, and were gone, and so they need to file a property damage report with the police department, because they need to. The damage is so much, they have to do that. It's state law. They need to do that for the insurance, or the insurance may not cover it if they don't have a police report. So they need to have that police report done. But they're at a Target parking lot, and they've waited 45 minutes and no police officer yet. And they've called again to say, you know, what's going on. They're busy. We're trying to free one up as soon as we can to get there. And 58 minutes later, the police officer finally shows up to take that damage report. Just think of what the customer has been thinking. I've been here almost an hour. And it's not just the, oh, whiny, why, you want to get this done. Maybe it's going to take them an hour before they can determine whether or not they need a tow truck or what they need to do. Maybe it wasn't at a Target store. Maybe it's somewhere else. I mean, you can't just wait inside the Target and wait for the police officer to show up. You got to be out by your car for when they show up. And so we don't think of these things that for them, they can't do a single thing in their life now until this property damage report is done. Their whole life is stopped. And it's not just that it's an inconvenience. Psychologically, it's a problem for them. Is my mom or dad going to kill me when they find out about this? I don't know what my next step is. I don't know if I'm going to lose my license. I don't know if I did something wrong. I don't know if the car needs to be towed. I don't know if it's towed. I don't know this. You know, all these things, it's really important for them at that point in time, even though for a police officer, how many times have I seen these? This is just a property damage report. Your life's going to be fine. And in a year, you won't even remember that. That's true. But at the moment today and for the next week and for the next month or so, I'm really going to be remembering how I was treated or what's going on now. I might color my perception of law enforcement for the rest of my life based on the one interaction I might ever have in my life with law enforcement. Hopefully the one interaction you would ever have. And I was thinking just today, I stopped to have lunch at Arby's with my wife. And we were waiting in line to order our food, and somebody else had gotten an order. I saw a lady come back up to the counter and was looking to get somebody's attention. And couldn't get attention from anybody right away. So then she actually said, excuse me, to somebody to try to get somebody's attention from behind the counter. And so another employee turned and looked at her, and you could tell they were distracted by whatever else they were doing and didn't really want to be dealing with that. And the person said, where can I get silverware? I just need a fork for my salad. And so the person turned back around and very annoyingly grabbed out of a bin a fork and just handed it over to the lady, barely making eye contact to her. And I thought, oh my gosh, how rude is that? That you can't even, I mean, the person can't eat their food until they get the fork. Their food may be, they may have a sandwich and a salad, and the sandwich is getting cold while they're waiting here because they didn't get everything they needed up front. They didn't get the fork right away. So I thought, oh, what a jerk move that is. That I hate when I see that people just don't care about other people. And then when that person turned back around, they touched their hand up to their earpiece and said, they said, do you want that small fries, medium, or large? And I realized, holy crap, at the moment they were trying to deal with the customer with the fork, they were also trying to take an order at the drive-thru over their headset. And she took like a little step sideways, and there's a cash register in front of her that I couldn't even see from where I was at. And I thought that made me think of this right here, right now. She's not trying to provide poor customer service, but she's trying to take care of her 90% of the jobs at the drive-thru. Can't take care of the customer who can't eat in the store because they can't get the fork. And then when they do get the fork, has a bad impression and feeling in their mouth because of the way it was delivered, because this person can't do the two things at one time. So even when you do show up for the BS medical call, we know what that means. You know, hey, you could... My mom and dad would have driven us in. That's great, but society is different now. And so you go there kind of with a poor attitude without trying to, and that, oh, we had to drop training for this or blah, blah, blah. And for that person, it's a real serious thing at the moment for them. They may have no other option. We don't understand their life story, their history, what's going on.
They called for a reason. That?
Exactly. To them, it was really important. So those are two examples I could think of.
Well, I think your fast food example is a great way to look at the difference between efficiency and effectiveness.
Yeah.
Okay. Fast food is about bottom dollar. I mean, they're selling entire lunches. Many places are selling entire lunches now for $5. There's this competition, it seems like, if you look at all the different fast food places. Mm-hmm. Oh, get your whole lunch for $5 or $5 lunch box or whatever. They're all about the dollar. It's a business. It's a private business. If people quit coming to their business because the service sucks, then they're going to add more staffing because, and they're going to raise the prices because now they got too efficient. Anybody can be efficient. In mm-hmm. my mind, you can get a 6-year-old kid to be efficient because efficiency is nothing but continually cutting things until it's no longer working, until you've gone out of business or until you're about out of business and you need to build back up. Efficiency is about cutting. Efficiency is, to me, is not about, it doesn't include value. Effectiveness mm-hmm. includes the value piece of it. And we've talked about that before. And so take your example, your fast food example. Yes, it's efficient to only have 3 employees behind the lunch counter or whatever. I'm just using picking 3 out of the air. Mm-hmm. It may be efficient to only have 3 employees behind the lunch counter at lunchtime when they're getting hammered, because 90% of the time the customers are getting what they expect. They come to a fast food restaurant, they don't expect great service, but they expect their food in a hurry. Maybe they'll figure out they could even be more efficient if they go down to 2 employees at lunch. I don't know. But based on that interaction that you just described, they may be at the tipping point where they are not effective anymore. They've become too efficient. They've lost their effectiveness to provide a good customer experience and food at a fast pace. Mm-hmm. That's where they're going to, where in fire departments, in the fire service, we cut for efficiency. We look for efficiencies all the time because that's what everybody tells us we need to do. We're not a business. When someone calls 911, they want a fire engine to show up at the front door. That's the reason they called 911. Mm-hmm. When we say we're going to do this 90% of the time, you'll have someone at your front door in 5 minutes or whatever your number is, your benchmark, to use the proper accreditation term. No, when someone calls 911, they want someone at their front door every time. They don't want a 90% chance that someone's going to come front door. When they dial 911 because their house is burning down, they dial 911 because they're in a car accident, they dial 911 because they're having chest pains. They want to feel like there's a 100% chance someone's going to show up at their front door within a reasonable amount of time. I know we can't do that. I realize that. I get it. Mm-hmm. But because we've said we're only going to do it 90% of the time, where it's accreditation or ISO or it's just our standards. When we build radio systems, we say our radios are only going to work 90% of the time. Everything we do nowadays is built to 90%. Mm-hmm. And with radios, we're lucky if we're at 70% sometimes. But anyways, that's a whole different subject. We've built this culture all of a sudden that we're not preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. We're hoping that we're good enough 90% of the time, and that the other 10% of the time, it really doesn't matter. And that's not a good mindset. That's not doing your job. We come to work every day to provide the best service we can, and we're not teaching that through the actions of the department that the department's taking.
All right. So I think some of that comes down to focusing on the statistics and the performance without keeping in mind the vision of the organization. So yeah, that's where it comes down to not seeing ideally what do we want to do, or at the core, what is our mission, or what do our customers expect from us? Because there's a difference between customer expectations and efficiency, effectiveness, productivity, profit and loss. Sometimes I think of it as it's a difference between the accounting standpoint and the customer services perspective. Because from an accounting standpoint, just-in-time delivery sounded like a great idea for part stocking and inventory suppliers. The reality of it is that customers got incredibly ticked off when, as an economic principle, we implemented that and found out that being able to deliver your order 90% of the time within 24 hours seems good on paper, but in reality, 10% of the time, if I can't get it, my entire production line is shut down because one of the 300 parts I need to assemble this component and get out the door is not able to be delivered. It's on back order for 2 weeks. Doesn't work at all. So try to find just-in-time delivery as the ideal business model now. Kind of build some reality back into it, realizing that you need to have a manageable inventory in stock to account for inability of suppliers to deliver. Or it's like disaster preparation. You need to have 3 days of food and water supply if the services are cut off. You have to build a loss factor into your productivity for the sake of acceptable customer service performance, and that's not built into those things. And one thing that kind of brought this home to me is we've got a sporting goods company that's based out of the Fargo-Moorhead area by the name of Shields. Competes with Gander Mountain. Well, they don't compete with Gander Mountain anymore, I guess, specifically. But
Cabela's,
but
and all the
Cabela's, Ganner Mountain, Dick's Sporting Goods. There are probably several others and other regional companies that I'm not aware of, but they're in the sporting goods market. And you've probably noticed that in the retail business as of late, it's a struggling marketplace, and the industry is trying to find out what the balance is between online shopping, online customer service, delivery at home, customer service, price, competition factor, all that kind of stuff. So at least in our area, we've seen sporting goods companies struggling. We've had two or three of them that have gone out of business in our area, and some big names that you wouldn't have expected. You know, boy, you wouldn't expect that Ganner Mountain would have difficulty. And I don't want to get into how did the business start, and then how did they expand, and where did they get to, and all that kind of stuff. But in an industry where big box retailers are having a hard time making ends meet, keeping stores open, the Scheels sporting goods stores are in an expansion mode and are adding locations across the country. And the CEO of Scheels talked to us in the city of Moorhead about how they've been actively courted to key mall areas that are still progressive and can demand top retailers, which also seems strange in this era of big box retailers struggling. And he's talking about a key development in Arizona and a key development down in the either Dallas or Houston area in a shopping mall where they can go out and seek the tenants they want to provide the customer experience that their customers expect. And he said that's what it comes down to for them, is that they deliver, their main goal is to deliver a positive customer service experience while selling sporting goods. They're not selling sporting goods for the most profit that they can, or for, you know, at the ideal profit point, price point, right, efficiency level, but they want to deliver the best customer service experience while you're shopping for sporting goods. So it's not that sporting goods is secondary, but they realize that if customer service is secondary to the products they're delivering, they won't be able to keep the retailer, especially now when markets are tight. When markets are loose and people are spending freely and the money is flowing everywhere, almost anybody could sell sporting goods and survive for a period of time. But that people want a good customer service experience, and in the end they will pay more for that. They will also be a repeat customer, and they'll be an active advocate for their service, which I guess is what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, by getting, do you work for Scheels?
I don't, but what's interesting, so it's, you know, it's that experience. They came in and did a management talk about this, and as I sat back and thought about it, I realized, you know, I go back to that particular store. I'm not a big sporting goods person. I don't have a ton of equipment. But I will go back to that store, and I know, walking into the store, I am going to pay more money for this. I can get it cheaper online. I would have been able to get it cheaper at other retailers locally while they were still in business to serve my needs. But I keep going back because I always walk out feeling good about myself at the end.
You feel good about spending extra money.
Good about the time that I spent there. Good about the money that I spent there.
Right.
Whereas another retailer, I don't want to badmouth people or organizations, so I won't name the other retailer, but there's another one where I've walked into looking for sporting goods needs, and I walk out feeling like they didn't really have what I was looking for. Nobody there seemed particularly helpful. They didn't seem to be appreciative of the fact that they were there, I guess. You know, you just walk out going, that wasn't what I wanted. And when I walk out of Scheels, even if I didn't buy the thing that I wanted to buy, I had had enough positive interactions with the staff members while I was there that I feel good about having spent my time there.
And you probably learned something, so you can find what you're looking for somewhere else, the better option.
You walk into the store and you feel that you were appreciated for having been there.
Yeah.
That you were important to them while you were there. And that after you leave, you'll still be important to them, even if you're going to go buy something somewhere else. And I've had experiences where they've said, we could do this, but I think you'd be better off doing something else, which didn't involve them selling a thing or involve somebody else.
See, that's effective. To me, that's
terribly effective.
That's an example. That's a great example of somebody being effective. That's the value piece that I was talking about. There's value in what they provide. You said yourself you're willing to pay a little bit more, knowing that you're probably going to pay a little bit more going there because the people that you interact with are good. The other place is worried about efficiencies. The other, you know, the other place where you couldn't find an employee to help you is worried about efficiencies. You know, that's not the first place you go. And our service should be about effectiveness. Our service should be not about what we can do efficiently 90% of the time. We should be looking at always being 100% 100% of the time. That should be our goal.
Right.
Shouldn't be doing it 90% of the time.
And it doesn't mean that the fire truck has to arrive for the I've been feeling sick for 3 days calls with lights and siren, or with an engine and an ambulance and a truck company. But did people arrive within a timely fashion? However that makes sense. were they empathic? Did they appear to want to be there, and were they concerned about my well-being? And did they try to improve my situation at the moment? But I obviously needed enough help that I felt I had to call somebody else.
Yep. But I think you hit on a little piece of it there. The little piece you said hit on a big point. Because we have decided that not every single call is important, our firefighters sometimes have trouble being empathetic towards those people because they're prioritizing the calls in their mind and how they act towards those people, towards our citizens.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, that person that's been sick for 3 days is a lower priority call, and I'm doing quotes in the air, you guys can't see because we're on the radio, is a lower priority call. And it puts the firefighter, the crew, on a different footing. Now, in their mind, it's a lower priority call, so they're not going to have it's not going to be as easy for them to give that person 100% of what they need.
Right, and I don't think that there are probably very many fire chiefs, captains, or firefighters that walk out the door or that are designing these systems or operating in them thinking, oh, okay, now in this one, don't care so much. It's okay to be annoyed. Take your time, you know, get there whenever. Obviously, shrug it off if you can. Drive a little slower if it looks like the ambulance is ahead of you or any of that kind of stuff. But when you use the terms like this is a lower priority call, or even just by stating these are the ones we're going to respond lights and sirens to, these are the ones we're not, I mean, it's the assumption has to be made that this one isn't as important to the customer. Without saying that, and I don't think any of us would actively go out and say, yeah, for that person who's been feeling sick for 3 days, to heck with them. Their problem doesn't matter. We know their problem matters.
Right.
But I don't feel that we need to change the terms and say, well, let's find a term that doesn't mean that then, because I hate all that kind of crap, too, where you try to change the terms. But
you can't wordsmith it out.
No. So there has to be an accompanying message along with prioritizing. Why are we doing this? Well, we're doing some of these things to manage risk, that we will take more risks for a riskier situation in the end, or where the impact is different, but that still doesn't negate how important it is to the caller that we get there and do a good job or provide them with the services that they think they need. Even if we would handle it differently if it was me or my family that was involved with that.
Right.
It's hard to say that without offending your staff by doing it, but if you don't at least accompany some of that kind of message that it's easy for us to get into this mindset because we're setting up a system for us to think about it this way subconsciously.
I think, though, this winds back to what we started the show with. It winds back to this, in my mind, in a way. And we all know that my mind is... there's not much bouncing around up there. But it's why you're doing it. And does the chief still have credibility?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a chief at a 30,000-foot level or up on the balcony, or however you want to put it, in the chief's mind, the chief's... and I'm using it as a general term again, looks at it and says, it's more efficient for us and it lowers our department's risk to respond to some of these calls as a lower priority. It makes sense from that perspective. From an operational perspective, it ruins the culture. And so it brings us back kind of to that same idea. It can ruin the culture.
Mm-hmm.
It brings us back to that same idea, is the perspective that you touched on. The perspective is different at the bottom level, at the fire station level, than it is at the administration level. And so it's important for the chiefs to have made the decision in the best interest of the department and to make sure that the department buys into those reasons. If the chief just says, no, we're not going to run on these calls anymore because we're putting too many miles on our engines, or we're... The risk of running license, having seven apparatus running license sirens to a fire alarm that we know is a false alarm 90% of the time, that's too much risk. They are. Those are all legitimate reasons. But to the staff that are operating at the day-to-day stuff, that 10% of the time when that fire alarm is a fire, or even the 1% of the time when that fire alarm is a fire, and you don't have all of your resources there, that's going to stick in their mind forever. So that's one problem. But the other problem is, I still go back to the culture. It changes the culture of the fire service. We're not preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. We're not. And it's bled into how we treat our people, which is what you just touched on, which is why I think I didn't see it coming, but now that I think about it, it all fits together.
Part of this is it's very easy to just to quantify, to measure your efficiency. There are metrics that you can use. I'm using fancy terms, but how many calls did your crew respond to a day? How many minutes out of the day were your crews engaged in call related activity? How many minutes were involved in inspections and in pre plans and training and all that stuff? So there are lots of things that we can measure. It's harder to measure your customer service experience mm-hmm. in black and white and numeric terms. And you can send out survey cards, and that's all great because to a certain point, you can actually probably measure through surveys. Were your customers happy with the service they were provided? So I guess that's not exactly the point that I'm making, but it's hard to justify to your city manager, to the leaders, how important that high level of customer service is. It's really hard to measure your customers' expectations and judge that against your budget, judge that against your mission, vision, values, and goals to determine what you ought to be doing that isn't necessarily efficient or that could be considered time better spent in other areas if all things were equal. And, of course, we're not. All things are not equal because we're dealing with people, and people have different perceptions and expectations. I'm floundering around with this thing. When I think about a city manager or another department director, when you get high enough up the chain, you get to start dealing with the crazy people in a different way than we do on the streets. So, you know, we deal with them day to day, the folks that have their own challenges or just a little bit off from maybe the norm of society, and we think that only we have to deal with those. But at the management level, you have to deal with walk-in customers that attend council meetings, those vocal kind of crazier individuals that have their own agendas that are weird, that are off the beaten track. And if you think about it, how much time other city staff members spend on people who've got sort of whacked out positions. They feel the government is spying on them, or they feel that their neighbor is...
Too much fluoride.
Three of their neighbors are cooking drugs, or you know, things that are just beyond reality, and you know they're beyond reality. And what you want to say is, this is a complete waste of my time. Get the hell out of here. You can't really do that. You can't listen to them as long as they want to ramble either. So you got to find that point of, listen, I have to take care of some people's needs that maybe don't meet the true definition of being totally important as a nature of morality, as a nature of our mission, as a nature of trying to do what we are due for doing our job. And they don't relate to how much money did we spend on putting asphalt on the streets? How many road miles did we resurface? What is our cost for picking up garbage versus the private sector in the next town who's doing it? But they are components of providing a government-level service that you need to take into account. So I don't know if those are those are anecdotes that can be used to try to explain to the higher ups, trying to tie it back into that chief's level again, that you also have to consider the human aspect of providing the services that we provide.
Well, I think you hit on something there I want to back up to for a second. It's part of your whole bigger idea, but it got me thinking is you said you can't measure effectiveness sometimes. You can't measure the level of the customer service.
You know it when you see it, though.
You do. But everybody's idea of good customer service is different, too, which is another problem with it. But I don't know if there's anything to this or not, but something that's come to mind while we were talking is, and it was the example you used, law enforcement is struggling in our country right now because of the public's perception of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have one interaction where you wait for an hour for law enforcement to show up to do a property accident report, and that happens 100 times a day, and it happens 365 days a year, that's a lot of people in your community that have had a poor experience. The fire department has traditionally... When you call 911, someone shows up at your front door. It doesn't take us an hour to get there, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And we are not having that problem. And I'm getting really, really off on a big tangent here. But does the fact that we have traditionally provided effective service bias the public in our favor when the law enforcement has for a longer time, say 10 years, I don't know what the number is, provided efficient service has it biased the public negatively towards them? And is the fire department, as we go down this road of efficiency in favor of effectiveness, going to bias the public towards us negatively in the future?
I think we have to be careful that we don't appear or start to sound like other organization or service delivery providers that are very obviously in that realm. So if we sound like a traffic ticket collector, you know, on a city street, then you get associated with the perceptions that you have of that. If you get associated with poor service at a restaurant because the terms are sounding the same, or because your attitude appears to be sort of the same, then I think you buy that onto your service as well, where that hasn't been our history in the past, just because that wasn't, like you said, that wasn't part of our culture.
No.
Our culture was respond quickly, do anything we can, do everything we possibly can while we're there if it makes sense. And try to care for people's needs at the same time, their psychological needs, their personal needs. And those intangibles are some of the things that can end up going by the wayside in this.
Yeah, I agree. I think we could color the public's perception towards us in a negative way if we're worried about efficiency or effectiveness. And I think our firefighters day-to-day do an excellent job of actually protecting us from that, because our firefighters are good people who got into this job for the right reason and they want to provide a good service to the community. So I think while administration is worried about efficiency, our firefighters are still being effective. But at what point is that tide, could that tide turn?
Right. So I think, as always, in lieu of providing the 12-step plan that will get us from the problem to the solution, or even thoroughly demonstrating that the problem exists and at what level, just being aware of the possibilities opens your mind to be aware of what might be going on in the service, what might be going on, and where we could be going if we're not paying attention, I guess. So
I think so. Something to think about.
Something to think about, yeah. And it was something to talk about today.
It was. We talked for a long time about that.
We sure did. Well, anyways, hey, we appreciate you hanging on this long with Tailboard Talk. We also appreciate our sponsor, Honeywell. I got a password lock on my system here, but the
Honeywell Scholarship. Honeywell, we want to go back to this each month, because each month Honeywell gives out scholarships for firefighters to go to FDIC. Full ride, FDIC entrance, hotel, travel. It's a heck of a good deal. The earlier you get your submissions in, the better chance you have, because you have more months to be considered. So
there you go.
Check out Honeywell. Go to FDIC.com, and you can get right to the scholarship program. The information there. Check it out. Sign up for it, man. It's a good deal.
There you go.
It seems early, but do it, do it, do it.
And that draws another episode of Tailboard Talk to a close. Appreciate you hanging in here with us. And maybe all three of us will be back in about 5 weeks or so when we do this whole thing again. Hopefully with a different topic.
Yeah.
I think we've always done a different topic from show to show, haven't we?
I don't think we've ever done the same topic twice.
Well, we should do the same topic twice. We haven't tried that. We've also talked about doing the bar show, which I guess you and Craig did once. And it turned out okay.
It did. We did a cold weather show, operating in cold weather at the bar.
Interesting.
We'll do that.
All right, we'll consider it again for the future.
All right.
All right. For Dane, Greg, and Jeff, thanks for tuning in to Tailboard Talk. Catch you next time.
Have a good night.
Thank you for listening to Tailboard Talk. Don't forget to tune in each week, Monday through Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 8:30 p.m. Pacific, for Fire Engineering Talk Radio. You can also subscribe to all of our shows on iTunes. Just search for Fire Engineering Talk Radio. Check out our educational programs and consultation services. They're all available at tailboardconsulting.com. There you can find links to all of our shows and our magazine articles. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another episode of Tailboard Talk on Fire Engineering Talk Radio.
So, cold enough for you? Accent? I don't have no accent.
Did you plug in the car?
Don't you know?
Oh no, we don't need no internet.
Well, you know, it's not the heat, it's that darn humidity. Yeah, Barb and I are going up north to the cabin this weekend.
I was supposed to be on the 35W bridge that night.
Going down to Target.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, I'm not eating at Taco John's. That's spicy stuff.
So the kids made this?
Oh, for cute. Well, if they don't have ketchup to go with the steak, then I'm just not interested.
Hey, hon, I'm going to stop over at Hans's house when I get off the ice later.
Okay, before I say this, let me just tell you, I'm not racist. Hey, Barb, where's the boat?
Yeah, my wife, she got a crappie in that ice fishing tournament.
Well, the Vikings blew it again this year, don't you know?
So this summer, me and Barb are taking the kids to the Black Hills for an awesome vacation. They got Bear Country USA out there.
Ah, the Vikings won a game, hon. We're going to the Super Bowl. Guess how long that hockey tournament lasted? All darn weekend, I tell ya.
You know, one thing about the summers here, the mosquitoes are big enough to carry off.
Well, you know what they say, if you don't like the weather, just wait 5 minutes.
We heard it's only 5 below and the northern are biting like crazy.
Well, here's one for you. My sister's boyfriend knows Joe Mauer.
So I says, Mr. Johansson, that's a nice fish. What'd you catch it on?
Can't believe the darn Twins missed the playoffs.
It's not soda, it's pap.
Oh, I'm more of a caribou guy myself.
Hey, Barb, can you have the kids go out and shovel the driveway?
Yeah, I pretty much love everything, Prince.
So get this, I won $100 playing pull tabs.
Oh yeah, we went on vacation to Valley Fair this year with the Jacobsons.
I got an idea, let's go to Wisconsin and fish in their lakes and hunt in their woods even though we got plenty of our own here, and drive like idiots while we're there.
Bad year to have a snowmobile.
I don't know how Minnesota drivers forget how to drive during the summer.
Well, as for me, I'm going to buy a snowblower with my tax refund.
Yeah, I'm starting to diet right after the state fair this summer.
Yeah, we're going to go see the wild game with the Ericssons.
Do you know Mr. Ingebretson got a job working over at the Best Buy?